Muller House meeting, Saturday afternoon, 6th October 1979. It is fit and proper. First, with our minds and our hearts, to pay homage to him who was the founder of this wonderful place, Elmar. You all know who he was. The man whose name was Johannes Muller. It is not easy to know the living man himself in his own inner being, in his own inner reality. The reality which is not only the external body which we knew as Johannes Muller, but that mind and spirit which was the inspiring source of this remarkable place, this peace of valley and beauty, this valley of peace and beauty. And it is right that we should pay homage to the memory of that man. Without him, we could not meet here. And not only to him do we owe a great debt of gratitude, but also to his children who carry on, who do their best to carry on the work which he initiated in his lifetime. It is through their kindness and gracious permission that we are able to meet together here and consider together the theme of our meeting today. Please do not think that I am here to teach you anything. I have nothing whatsoever to teach you. The one thing that I do know is that I do not know. But if you will be gracious enough to listen to me with your hearts willing and your mind alert, then together we can be in a state of inner communion which will release something whose value we cannot measure in the ordinary way. Our subject is the art of living humanly. You may wonder, why have I chosen such a subject? Every one of us knows the state of the world today, how it is moving thoughtlessly, carelessly, almost evil-mindedly to the brink of catastrophe. It is true that catastrophe precedes construction and the beginnings of a new life. But there is one thing that human beings do not yet understand, that there is catastrophe which is unnecessary for our development and our fulfillment. There is so much sorrow which we heap upon ourselves almost deliberately, and that denies the possibility of living humanly in the world. Johannes Müller was a man who knew how to live humanly in tune with nature first and foremost, in harmonious relationship with his fellow men and women. He had the ability to live in tune, in perfect harmony with his own vision of life. And by this vision of life, I do not mean just his own thought out, intellectual, fixed conception of life, but a vision which was a living and growing reality constantly, inspired by transcendence itself, by God, if you like to use the word God. And therefore, he dedicated his life to the service of God insofar as he was able to do so, seeing God essentially through him who was Johannes Müller, the representative, the living embodiment of godliness on this earth, his own teacher, Jesus Christ. Not merely as Jesus Christ was presented to him in books or in theological treatises and so forth, but in the manner in which he himself saw with his spiritual eye, his purified vision, purified of human difficulties and faults, the meaning of the teacher Jesus Christ. And that is something very, very rare. And there is so much to learn from that. Let us take just the first point, living in tune with nature. How do we in the world today, dominated by the pride and conceit of our technological achievements, regard nature? Is it not strange that we always talk in terms of the conquest of nature? Do we conquer nature? Can we conquer nature? 5,000 million years have passed since the earth danced with precision and with unfailing delight round her Lord the Sun. And then I, the ordinary man, was born. A mere 70 years, 80 years, maybe 100 years, I shall live. And then I shall be dead, and the earth will continue to dance around the sun for perhaps another 5,000 million years, my little life making no difference to nature, my conceit only a little cloud of folly shutting out the light and the beauty of life itself. Now, all nature works together to produce me all the same. Therefore, this which nature brought into being cannot and should not be in conflict with nature. And if it is not in conflict with nature, there is no meaning whatsoever to this tragic phrase, conquering nature. Because one of the worst results of that attitude is simply this, that if we think in terms of conquering nature, we are doing harm to ourselves and to our whole environment, especially our human environment. Each one of us then is against our fellow human beings. But if we understand nature, if we live in harmony with her, see her as our constant mother who brought us into being, sustains us and nourishes us quietly, without complaining, and then, when we are dead, uncomplainingly receives us back into her bosom. Although we may have, out of our own desire to exploit her resources, dug deep into her bowels. That's hardly the way to behave towards mother. And the earth is our mother, and a beautiful mother too, a gracious mother. Sometimes she has her troubles also, as all mothers have. And then we witness volcanoes and earthquakes and so on, which engulf us and other living things in destruction. But it is for us to understand that. Nature acts, in a sense, unconsciously, in complete harmony, however, with the laws of her being, which she cannot disobey. She has no option in the matter. But you and I, as human beings, perhaps her most remarkable creation since the earth came into being, have this power of exercising option. I will cooperate with you, I will not cooperate with you. And that is our responsibility. Nature does everything else for us, and it is our responsibility to learn to cooperate with us, to cooperate with her. And in cooperating with nature, we are cooperating also with that aspect of nature which always remains the great mystery, the transcendent reality underlying, animating all nature itself. Nature is the feminine counterpart of this masculine, if you like, masculine transcendent power. And the transcendence, in a strange way, holds both the feminine and the masculine within itself. It is important to understand this, because if we do understand that, then we shall understand something very, very wonderful. Each and every one of us has both masculine and feminine elements, whether the body be male or whether the body be female. Now, insofar as we are able to relate harmoniously the masculine and feminine forces within our own being, then we realize a true psychophysical harmony. Now, when that psychophysical harmony is realized, we have begun to be human. Until then, we are not properly human, completely human. We are subhuman. That is to say, we are still on the way to growing in such a manner that humanity in the real sense at last begins to function naturally and spontaneously from within ourselves. Now this harmony of the masculine and feminine elements in our own being is the most practical, the most concrete meaning of the marriage made in heaven. This is something very important to understand, because if we see it as the marriage made in heaven, and if we are free from the conceit which makes us say, oh, I have done this, I can't do anything at all, really. If we have the conceit to say, I have done this, then we ourselves annul that marriage. And the masculine and feminine elements are again divorced and in conflict with each other. And this leads to endless trouble and misery in life, not only in terms of physical health, but in terms of our psychical life and in terms of all that which brings the mind to maturity. Nature brings the physical body to maturity. After that, she hands over to us the task, which is our responsibility, to purify the psyche and allow the mind to come to full maturity. Then at last, we are human. Not children. And then, quite naturally, quite easily, we can live humanly. Just try and picture this world with its enormous population today of nearly 4,000 million, having at least a reasonable minority, because they will only be a minority, having at least a reasonable minority of full-fledged human beings. What sort of a world would it be? Do you think we would have our wars and our strikes, our anxieties, our suspicions and hatreds, our national and international difficulties and problems and so forth? They just wouldn't be there. And you may say, oh, you're talking like an idealist, you're not practical. May I suggest that perhaps this is far more practical than what people ordinarily call practical. Whatever the state of the world is the result of what you and I as individuals think, feel, desire, work for, speak, and act. It is the result of it all. All our institutions, all our laws, where do they come from? You and me. We are the originators of it. And if we are not truly human, but only subhuman, in a state of conflict, all our institutions and all that we hope will bring forth a better state of affairs will not bring fulfillment or human living to mankind. This is a very important point. You may ask, well, surely this is obvious to any intelligent person. Why hasn't the world seen it already and worked accordingly? You know what we human beings are like. We are unwilling to say, I am wrong. We are unwilling to shoulder our personal responsibility. Oh, let the other man do it. He is the boss. He is the teacher. He will do it all. No. Can he breathe on your behalf? Can your bloodstream flow through your body, your heart beat, if he is to take charge of it? You have to be in charge yourself, you have to breathe yourself. When you're hungry, somebody else can't eat for you. You have to eat yourself and digest it. So you see, this strange tendency on the part of man to refuse to shoulder his responsibilities is one of the great reasons why man does not see the simple fact, the practical fact, of his own actual responsibility. Now, I mentioned Johannes Müller lived in tune with his own vision of life and his own sense of transcendence, which put him in touch with that great mystery we call God. He was able to relate all these four aspects, being in tune with nature, with his fellow men, with his vision of life, with his sense of transcendence. He was able to relate all those into one great whole. And it is to that whole that it's so difficult to find the right word. It is to that holiness to which he gave himself. Note, he gave himself. His total self. You all know in the New Testament some of the words of Jesus. Unto Caesar, render what is Caesar's, but unto God, what is God's. And what is God's? The total cosmos, the total reality, which includes you and me. And therefore, if we as conscious human beings awake in some degree or other to profound truth and reality, were really to abide by that, we would see that we have to give the whole of ourselves to this great mystery, transcendence itself. And this is not a self-sacrifice at all. This is only waking up to the fact that this is the truth of our existence. And if we do not live by that truth, we are living in a state of sin. And what happens to him who is in a state of sin? Remember St. Paul? The wages of sin is death. That death of the soul, so to say, that spiritual death, which therefore means that we, the living people, have lived in vain, not purposefully, with the right purpose animating us. And the right purpose of life is not your purpose or my purpose, with our petty little vision spun out by our imperfect intellects, but the purpose which is the divine purpose. And if we are quiet and still and silent in our own minds and hearts, and all our desires and longings are at peace, not in conflict, then that divine purpose for us will naturally find fulfillment without our knowing it. And this is the important thing, without our knowing it. Because the supreme wisdom, the supreme knowledge, is an unknowing wisdom. You may say, well, what do you mean by saying such a thing? Just this. look into our own minds. Let us look into our own minds. Whatsoever we think we know has a specific mental form. It is limited. It is not unlimited. It is imperfect, not perfect. Because if it were perfect, there would be no further growing, no further developing at all. We would have come to the end. And there is no such thing as the end. We live in terms of time because our vision is so short. But the transcendent lives in terms of eternity. And eternity contains all time within itself. And it contains all time without the deficiencies of time, without the ups and downs and the conflicts and the miseries that time brings into our life, in other words, which mortality brings into our life. Eternity lives containing all this in such a manner that there is a constant transformation taking place of that which is not perfect into the perfect, of that which is not truly fulfilled in any aspect of life and throughout the cosmos is ultimately fulfilled. Why do I say that? How do we live? We live by trying to counteract what displeases us or what brings us trouble or harm. As for example, when we are ill, we take some medicine to counteract the symptoms. Or we give a palliative, a pill or a mixture which tranquilizes us. But that is dope. That is not real healing. Where does healing come from? It doesn't come from the level of the disease or the plane of the conflict or sorrow or disharmony. It comes from a transcendent dimension, a transcendent depth. Because healing is a living process, and whatsoever is truly living is still a mystery to us. Complete mystery. What makes the body live? Here we find a person is alive. There comes a time when ultimately he takes what we call his last breath and he's dead. What's happened to him? Why is there a last breath? Why is he dead? We don't know. We just say, oh, the life has departed from him. But in saying that, if we ask, well, what is this thing, life? No answer. Where has it departed? No answer. So you see, it is out of the depths of transcendence that healing comes. It's a great mystery. It's a wonderful mystery. And we put ourselves in harmony with that mystery and that transcendent power if we are quiet and still and do not make a noise or try to make a noise in the world. We are interferers with life instead of being cooperators, intelligent cooperators in harmony with life. Therefore, we are unable truly to live humanly. We live slightly humanly. We live subhumanly. But this is not intended to be to suggest that man is an evil thing. Not at all. We are at different stages. We have to understand that. And if we truly understand this power of compassion, true compassion, which is also a mystery, acts from within us. True compassion is not just pity or some condescension which makes us say, oh, poor man, he's in this difficulty, etc., etc., and then perhaps we just pass by. That is not it. When compassion works, when love works in its profoundest way, we don't know it. All of us have some time or other, at least, fallen in love, as we say. Some of us have not fallen in love, but have awakened to the transcendent reality of love. And have you noticed that when that happens, and it happens so rarely, but when that happens, the brain doesn't know it. It is there naturally. Supposing you find a man who is strong, healthy, handsome, and you find a woman who is utterly beautiful and attractive and so forth, and if they are truly handsome and truly beautiful, they are not aware of it until that innocence in their minds and hearts is spoilt by other people who talk about it and who try to possess that person. You see, all these things are involved in understanding how and whence true healing emerges. Whole making, making whole, complete, perfect. Now, all these elements are involved in these simple things. And in the fact that they are all interrelated, living in harmony with nature, with people around us, with your own vision, true vision of life, and with that awakened sense of transcendence. That is why I am inclined to say, although I know so little of what Johannes Müller wrote, I never had the privilege to meet him whilst he was alive, but seeing these things in his works and in some of the writings which are translated into English, I am inclined to say he was a theologian whose theology shone with the light of his own originality. And his originality was inspired by his awakened sense of transcendence within his own being. Now this brings me to one of the most important aspects, his own awakened sense of transcendence. This is a supreme mystery. We don't know just what happens. But when that sense of transcendence awakens, then you will find that the whole course of your everyday life changes. Your circumstances around you change. The activity and the behavior of other people with whom you are working or involved, that also changes. And an extraordinary state of harmony gradually seeps in, like healing waters. This is what actually happens. Now, in relation to this, let me finish by reading two short passages out of old scriptures. You all know your New Testament well enough, you all know your Christianity well enough, so I'm not quoting from that at the moment. But one is from the Buddhist teachings, in which people ask the Buddha, what is the greatest blessing on earth? And I'm going to quote only a little bit. Not to serve the foolish, but to serve the wise, to honor those worthy of honor. This is the greatest blessing. To support father and mother, to cherish wife and child, to follow a peaceful calling, this is the greatest blessing. Just those two verses out of 11 verses which constitute the whole thing. And then another one from one of the early Vedas, not very well known, the Atharva Veda, Atharva. And an Atharvan is a priest, not just an ordinary priest, but one who is himself the living embodiment of the great religious truths. He is called an Atharvan, you see. And this, in this Atharva Veda, we have one quite remarkable hymn. Freedom from hate I bring to you, concord and unanimity. Love one another as the cow loves the calf that she hath borne. And remember, the Atharva Veda is more than 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. Love one another, just stated in so many simple words. But the simile is quite interesting. As the cow loveth the calf. You must remember that for that civilization, cattle played a very important part in their life. One-minded with his mother, let the son be loyal to the father. Let the wife, calm and gentle, speak words sweet as honey to her lord. No brother hate his brother, no sister to sister be unkind. Unanimous with one intent, speak ye your speech in friendliness. You may say, but this is simple morality, and all that sort of talk is somewhat old-fashioned. Very well. Let us agree, it is old-fashioned. But tell me, you and I, each one of us as a psychophysical person, is the same kind of psychophysical person as flourished 3, 4, 5,000 years ago. So you and I as living organisms are old-fashioned. So what's wrong with such a simple morality which served a wonderful purpose for those old-fashioned people? To me it seems as if this is the perfect answer to the somewhat impetuous, not altogether wise, inexperienced young folk, some young folk over the world, who like to throw overboard all this which is real wisdom. And I mention this as the last point because tomorrow I would like to develop the situation from this point. and we'll try and consider together certain matters of the profoundest import connected with the relationship of that which is transcendent to that which is worldly. That which is infinite, eternal and immortal to that which is finite, temporal and mortal. Thank you.